And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's November 17th. 321st day of the year. Leap year is 322nd. 44 days remain till the end of this year. Well, this day in history, a lot of things have happened. In the year 887, Emperor Charles the Fat's deposed by the Frankish magnates in an assembly at Frankfurt. His nephew, Arnulf of Carinthia, is elected as king of the East Frankish kingdom. In 1183, the Genpei War, the Battle of Mizujima, takes place off the Japanese coast, where Minamoto no Yoshinaka's invasion force is intercepted and defeated by the Taira clan. 1292, John Baliol becomes King of Scotland. 1405, Sharif al-Hashim establishes the Sultanate of Sulu. 1511, Henry VIII of England concludes the Treaty of Westminster. This is a pledge of mutual aid against the French with Ferdinand II of Aragon. 1558, the Elizabethan era begins. Queen Mary I of England dies, succeeded by her half-sister Elizabeth I of England. 1603, English explorer, writer, and courtier Sir Walter Raleigh goes on trial for treason. 1777, Articles of Confederation in the U.S. are submitted to the states for ratification. They didn't want to form a single kingdom or country, but they did want to support each other. 1796, French Revolutionary War. Battle of the Bridge of Arcole. French forces defeat the Austrians in Italy. In the year 1800, the U.S. Congress holds its first session in Washington, D.C., and it's gotten no better than then. 1810, Sweden declares war on its ally, the U.K., to begin the Anglo-Swedish War. Although no fighting ever takes place, it's a paper war. 1811, Jose Miguel Carrera, Chilean founding father, sworn in as president of the executive junta of the government of Chile. 1820, Captain Nathaniel Palmer becomes the first American to see Antarctica. The Palmer Peninsula is later named after him. 1831, Ecuador and Venezuela are separated from Gran Colombia. 1837, an earthquake in Valdivia, south central Chile, causes a tsunami that leads to significant destruction along Japan's coast. 1856, in the American Old West, on the Sonoita River in present-day southern Arizona, the U.S. Army establishes a Fort Buchanan in order to help control new land acquired in the Gadsden Purchase. 1858, modified Julian Day Zero from the Julian calendar. 1858, the city of Denver, Colorado is founded. 1863, in the American Civil War, the siege of Knoxville begins. Confederate forces led by General James Longstreet place Knoxville, Tennessee under siege. 1869, in Egypt, the Suez Canal linking the Mediterranean with the Red Sea is inaugurated. 1878, the first assassination attempt against Umberto I of Italy by anarchist Giovanni Passanati. It was armed with a dagger. The king survived with a slight wound to his arm. Prime Minister Benito Carreon blocked the aggressor, getting an injury in the leg. 1885, Serbio-Bulgarian War. The Battle of Slivnica begins. 1894, H.H. Holmes, one of the first modern serial killers, is arrested in Boston, Massachusetts. There was a suspicion that he was Jack the Ripper, but it was never proven. 1896, the Western Peninsula Hockey League, which later became the first hockey league to open a trade and hire players, began to play at Pittsburgh Schenley Park Casino. 1903, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party splits into two groups, the Bolshevik which is Russian for the majority, and the Mensheviks, Russian for minority. 1939, nine Czech students are executed as a response to an anti-Nazi demonstration prompted by the death of Jan Opelto. All Czech universities are shut down. More than 1,200 students are sent to concentration camps. Since this event, International Students' Day is celebrated in many countries, especially in the Czech Republic. 1947, a Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood implements an anti-communist loyalty oath. 1947, American scientists John Bardeen and Walter Huser Brittain observed the basic principles of the transistor, a key element for the electronics revolution of the 20th century. 1950, Lamo Dundrub is officially named the 14th Dalai Lama. 1950, United States Security Council Resolution 89 relating to the Palestinian question is adopted. Now, they don't often tell you what's in these things. But after getting complaints from Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and the chief of staff of the Truth Supervision Organization regarding the implementation of the armistice agreements designed to end the Arab-Israeli war, the council requested the Egypt-Israel Mixed Armistice Commission give urgent attention to a complaint of expulsion of thousands of Palestinian Arabs. And the council called on both parties to give effect to any finding by the commission, repatriating any such Arabs who the commission believes to be entitled to return. And then the council authorized the chief of staff of the Truth Supervision Organization to recommend to Israel, Egypt, and such other Arab states appropriate steps he may consider necessary to control the movement of nomadic Arabs across international frontiers. In other words, basically they said, hey guys, let's play nice. 1953, the remaining human inhabitants of the Blasket Island, Kerry, Ireland, are evacuated to the mainland. The interesting thing about these particular islands, there was a lot of They're an uninhabited group of islands off the west coast of Ireland, and they're part of County Kerry. Abandoned in 1954 due to population decline, they're best known today for the storytelling of Maurice O'Sullivan and the Pig Sayers. And in the 1980s, Thomas Charles Howey purchased Inishvikalane on the island. They were inhabited until 1953 by a completely Irish-speaking population. At its peak, they had about 175 residents. Population declined to 22 by 1953. And due to the increasingly extreme weather, it left the island cut off emergency services. The government evacuated the remaining residents to the mainland. Both the islanders and the government saw this as a necessary act. Many of the former residents still live on the Dingle Peninsula, which is where they can view their former home. And the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, the islanders are subject to much anthropological and linguistic study. There were a number of books written by islanders that record much of their tradition and way of life. The Blasket Islands have been called Next Parish America, based on the idea the next parish west of the islands would be in North America. And the Irish language didn't historically distinguish the United States of America from Canada. In fact, the next Roman Catholic priest parish west of the Blasket Islands is St. John's, Newfoundland in Canada. There is a ferry service, but it doesn't really do much. Okay, 1957. Vickers Viscount G.A.O.H.P., a British European Airways, crashes at Ballyroup after the failure of three engines on approach to Copenhagen Airport. Causes a malfunction of the anti-icing system on the aircraft. Nobody died, but it was embarrassing and expensive to the company. 1962, President Kennedy dedicates Washington Dulles International Airport, which serves Washington, D.C., Been there a number of times. Mass confusion. 1967, Vietnam War. Acting on optimistic reports he'd been given November 13th, President Lyndon Baines Johnson tells the nation that while much remained to be done, we're inflicting greater losses than we're taking. We're making progress. 1968, British European Airways introduces the BAC-111 into commercial service. 1968, viewers of the Raiders-Jets football game in the eastern U.S. are denied the opportunity to watch its exciting finish when NBC broadcast Heidi instead. This resulted in changes to sports broadcasting in the U.S. 1969, Cold War. Negotiators from the Soviet Union and the U.S. meet in Helsinki, Finland to begin SALT I negotiations. SALT I aimed at limiting the number of strategic weapons on both sides. And once they arrived at an agreement, of course, it was immediately violated by both sides. 1970, Vietnam War. Lieutenant William Calley goes on trial for the My Lai massacre. He moved to Columbus after leaving the military, moved to Columbus, Georgia, married the daughter of a very wealthy jeweler, and he wound up he was assistant manager of the jewelry store. At least he could do that without a problem. 1970, Lunar Program. Soviet Union lands Lunokhod 1 on the Mare Imbrium, or the Sea of Rains on the moon. First roving remote-controlled robot to land on another world is released by the orbiting Luna 17 spacecraft. 1973, Watergate scandal. In Orlando, Florida, President Richard Nixon tells 400 Associated Press managing editors, "I am not a crook." 1973, the Athens Polytechnic uprising against the military regime ends in a bloodshed in the Greek capital. 1983, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation is founded in Mexico. 1989, in the Cold War, the Velvet Revolution begins. In Czechoslovakia, a student demonstration in Prague is quelled by riot police. This sparks an uprising aimed at overthrowing the communist government, and it does succeed on December 29, 1989. 1990, Fugendake, part of the Mount Unzen volcanic complex, Nagasaki Prefecture in Japan, becomes active again and erupts. 1993, in Nigeria's General Sani Abaka ousts the government of Ernest Sonokan in a military coup. 1997, in Luxor, Egypt, 62 people are killed by 6 Islamic militants outside the Temple of Hatshepsut, known as the Luxor Massacre. In the year 2000, a catastrophic landslide in Lagpad and Gartum in Slovenia kills 7 and causes millions in damages. It's one of the worst catastrophes in Slovenia in the past 100 years. Also that same year, 2000, Alberto Fujimori is removed from office as president of Peru. 2012, at least 50 school children were killed in an accident at a railway crossing near Manfalut in Egypt. 2013, 50 people were killed when Tatarstan Airlines Flight 363 crashes at Kazan Airport in Russia. 2013, a rare late-season tornado outbreak strikes the Midwest. Illinois and Indiana, the most affected with tornado reports, as far north as lower Michigan. All in all, about 6 dozen tornadoes touched down in approximately an 11-hour period. 7 are EF3 and 2 EF4 tornadoes. 2019, the first known case of COVID-19 is traced to a 55-year-old man who visited a market in Wuhan, Hubei province in China. Of course, the Chinese deny that. They say it's the CIA. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. But holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day. Asiscus. Agnan of Orleans. Elizabeth of Hungary. Genebius of Constantinople in the Greek Orthodox Church. Gregory of Tours in the Roman Catholic Church, Gregory Thaumaturgus, Hilda of Whitby, Hugh of Lincoln, International Students' Day, Martyrs' Day in Orissa in India, President's Day in the Marshall Islands, Struggle for Freedom and Democracy Day in the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and World Prematurity Day. We have some interesting holidays, I do have to say. All right, let's see what else we got. In 473, the future Zeno the First is named Associate Emperor by Emperor Leo the First. In 1555, William of Orange becomes a member of Council of State. In 1558, Elizabeth I, who was only 25 at the time, ascended the English throne upon the death of her half-sister, Queen Bloody Mary, as she was called. 1558, the Church of England is reestablished. In 1636, Henrique Dias, Brazilian general, wins a decisive battle against the Dutch in Brazil. And let's see, 1774, the first city troop, the Philadelphia City Cavalry, formed at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia. That's the oldest U.S. military unit still in service. 1785, the Church of England organizes in New England. Let's see. In 1812, in the Napoleonic Wars, the Battle of Krasnoy during Napoleon's retreat from Moscow. 1827, the Delta Pi Fraternity, America's oldest continuous social fraternity, founded at Union College in Schenectady, New York. In 1853, street signs are finally authorized at San Francisco intersections. On this date in 1855, David Livingstone becomes the first European to see Victoria Falls in what's now Zambia and Zimbabwe. Well, why did it do that? In 1862, Confederate Secretary of War George Randolph resigns. 1862, Union General Ambrose Burnside marches north out of Washington, D.C. to begin the Fredericksburg Campaign. If I'm not mistaken, he got his head handed to him. 1863, Abraham Lincoln on this date begins his first draft of his Gettysburg Address. 1874, the immigrant ship Cospatrick catches fire and sinks off Auckland, New Zealand. 1884, police arrest boxer John L. Sullivan in his second round for being cruel to his opponent. Apparently, they had money riding on his opponent. 1917, Lenin defends a temporary removal of freedom of the press. 1918, German troops evacuate Brussels. 1922, the last sultan of the Ottoman Empire, Mehmed VI, is expelled to Malta on a British warship. The monarchy was abolished, and that was it. In 1928, Notre Dame loses its first football game at home after 23 years. Well, let's see. 1931, Charles Lindbergh inaugurates Pan Am service from Cuba to South America in the Sikorsky flying boat American Clipper. And I think that's it on our history for today. Let's see what else we've got in the way of ghost towns. I was talking yesterday about North Brother Island in New York. It lies between Rikers Island and the borough of Bronx. It's in the East River. You know, throughout the decades, North Brother Island served as home for World War II veterans and a treatment center for adolescent drug addicts, but found the abandoned nearly 60 the city decided it was too expensive to maintain. It's now a sanctuary for a colony of black-crowned night herons. It's off-limits to the general public. The remains of the old buildings are shedding bricks, according to one public official. In other words, they are collapsing. Though the city occasionally authorizes individual visits, according to one photographer, it's an incredible feeling being on the island. You're seeing the city, you're hearing it, but you're completely alone. Let's go to Chile. What's called the White Gold Wasteland, Humberstone. During the Golden Age of Saltpeter from 1880 to 1930, Humberstone was monumentally important. It accounted for between 60 and 80% of Chilean exports and between 40% and 60% of Chile's financial revenue. It's located in northern Chile's remote Pampas region. Inhospitable Atacama deserts filled with salt flats, geysers, volcanoes, and the abandoned saltpeter mines of Humberstone and Santa Laura. Built on the site of the world's largest saltpeter deposit in 1880, Humberstone, the largest of the mines, was named after its founder, James Thomas Humberstone. He was a British chemical engineer who made his fortune off the substance.
Motion detected at the front door.
So you have to ask yourself, why was saltpeter so valuable? It was distilled from the nitrate-rich deposits of caliche, the chemical. It was used to make the fertilizer that fueled the growing agricultural expansion in the Americas and in Europe. Caliche is also known as sodium nitrate. The source of almost all the world's saltpeter, which is also known as white gold, the mines of Atacama single-handedly fuel the Chilean economy. Chile literally lived off one product, according to Julio Pinto, a historian at the University of Santiago. But harvesting the substance was backbreaking work for the Peruvian, Bolivian, and native Pampino miners. The work goes on incessantly. Gang following gang, crushes, grinding caliche, boilers, dissolving it to stew in its own juice, according to one contemporary observer. And nitrate of soda yielding itself up in the tanks night and day to be sent all over the world. And now during the golden age of saltpeter, which, as I said, lasted from 1880 to 1930, Humberstone was home to about 3,500 people. But the boom began to wane when the British began blocking exports to Germany during World War I. In response, German scientists developed synthetic saltpeter, which ended the need for the genuine article and decimated the Chilean economy. Within 30 years, both Humberstone and Santa Laura were ghost towns. After the mines were abandoned in the 1960s, they were occupied by homeless people. There was rubbish everywhere, graffiti, the mummified bodies of dead dogs, and the occasional body of dead human. Now recognized as United Nations World Heritage Sites, the former settlements contain the remains of more than 200 saltpeter works. In Humberstone, you'll see a well-preserved bandstand, rows of workers' homes, a movie theater, and a town clock that stopped. These days, it's always 4 o'clock in Humberstone. Let's go to Mexico. The Peyote Pueblo, Real de 14. According to one visitor, you go through the tunnel and it's like an opening to another world. You just feel like you're going back in time. And you really feel isolated. This was once a prosperous mining settlement in the Mexican state of San Luis Potosi. Real de 14, or Royal 14, was named for 14 Spanish soldiers who were killed by Chichimeca warriors. Now a ghost town, or as they call it, a Pueblo Fantasma. It rises 9,000 feet into the Sierra de 14 range and can only be reached by driving up a 17-mile cobblestone road and through a century-old 1.5-mile tunnel. And when you get past that, the dusty town seems forever frozen in time. 1772, discovery of silver in the Real de 14 area jump-started a mining industry that reached its heyday in the late 1900s. At its peak, the late 1800s, at its peak, Real de 14 had a population of 15,000. A bull ring and stores that sold European luxury goods, but the Mexican Revolution, coupled with declining silver prices, led to its abandonment in the early 1900s. Today, this area is associated with far less materialistic riches, thought to be a locus of spiritual energy. Real de 14 is a sacred destination for both Catholics and native Mixarica pilgrims. The Catholics come to venerate a statue of St. Francis of Assisi in the still active Parroquia de la Purísima Concepción, Parish of the Virgin Birth. While the Mixarica visit a sacred spot where they believe is the birthplace of the sun. Secular tourists come for the town's otherworldly ambiance, the abandoned Concepcion mine, the old cockfighting arena, and more. And not the least, they seek peyote, the hallucinogenic cactus that flourishes in the nearby Chihuahuan Desert, and is considered a doorway to the deities by the Mixarica. Though buying peyote is illegal in Mexico, authorities tend to ignore the individuals who charge vision questers $16 for a jeep ride into the mountains where the stoner supplicants ingest two buttons of the medicine and prepare to meet the gods. I mean, one way to look at it is you've got actually two trips in one. A trip to the ghost town and a trip to see the gods. And then from there we go to Goldfield, Arizona. And we talk about the Lost Dutchman Mine. Early 1900s, Goldfield saw a brief revival when George Young, Arizona's secretary and acting governor, brought new mining techniques to the area, which he renamed Youngberg. 5 years later, after his techniques failed, the town was once again deserted. Located just east of Phoenix, the Superstition Mountains are the source of many eerie legends, not the least of which is the story of the Lost Dutchman Mine. According to the legend, the mine was first discovered by Jacob Waltz, a German prospector who died under mysterious circumstances while searching for the lode in the late 19th century. Germans were quite often known as Dutchmen in those days. Though the mine has never been found, high-quality gold ore was discovered on a hill between the Superstition and Goldfield Mountains in 1892. As miners flocked into the area to capitalize on this find, the town of Goldfield was born. Before long, saloons, a brewery, a blacksmith, a butcher shop, and a post office were built. At its peak, the place was home to 1,500. But 5 years after the town was founded, the gold began to run out and the miners moved on, as is typical. Today, the search for the mysterious Lost Dutchman Mine continues, and so do the casualties. In 2009, a Denver man died while searching for the mine. In 2010, three hikers from Utah were found dead. It's no wonder the area is supposedly plagued by what some call the Dutchman's Curse. And of course, in the case of each of these, the bodies were so weathered they couldn't tell what actually killed them. Then let's go to Italy for the Devil's Hand, Pendotiello. The strange lock formations and haunting legends of Pendotiello have long intrigued writers and artists who created lithographs and woodcuts depicting the town's ruins. In the spring of 1686, the Baron Bernardino Abenovoli, scion of the influential Calabrian family, set out to marry Antoinetta Alberti, who lived in her family's castle in Pendadetillo, a town on Cavario Mountain, about 7 miles south of the Abenavoy. But their families were enemies, and even worse, Antonetta was betrothed to another man, Don Petrillo Cortez. Well, this didn't stop the Baron, who broke into the Alberti castle one night, murdered most of its occupants, and spirited Antonetta away to his castle. When Cortez's father sent emissaries to avenge the murders, the Baron fled to Malta, leaving Antonetta in a loveless life in a Regilio Calabrian nunnery. Now entirely abandoned, Pendadetillo is said to be haunted by the ghost of the Albertis. Indeed, some say the bloody handprint of Antonetta's father, Lorenzo, was once permanently planted on the wall of the castle. And when the wind blows through the rock outcroppings, his screams can be heard echoing. And this belief is what gave the town its name. The Greeks who founded it called the rock formation Pendadactylos, meaning five fingers. Some even claim to the hand of the devil himself. In a 1915 travelogue, Old Calabria, Norman Douglas called the formation the most singular landmark, which looks exactly like a molar tooth turned upside down with the fangs in the air. Well, over time, of course, the rocky digits have been reshaped along with the rest of Pendadetillo by earthquakes, one of which prompted the abandonment of the town in the mid-20th century. And today, almost nothing is left of the castle, while the ruined houses lie scattered beneath the jagged rocks. In the crevices and holes of this fearfully savage pyramid, the houses of Pendadetillo are wedged, according to the English poet Edward Lear. While darkness and terror brood over the abyss around this, the strangest of all human abodes. Well, in the Cyprus, we have the ruined Riviera, Varosha. One United Nations intelligence officer said of Varosha in 1970, it was like a town after an atomic war. Parts of it had been bombed. It would be very good to set to make a film about a bombed city. In the early 1970s, Varosha Resort in the city of Famagusta on the east coast of Cyprus was one of the most popular tourist destinations in the world. It was a sun-kissed Mediterranean playground with balmy beaches, luxurious hotels, and lavish restaurants. It attracted the likes of Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and Brigitte Bardot. According to one American or Greek Cypriot heritage, anyone who comes from Varosha has a romanticized notion about it. They talk of being the hub of art and intellectual activity. They describe it as the French Riviera of Cyprus. Well, all that changed in 1974 when Turkey invaded Cyprus, displacing Famagusta's nearly 40,000 residents, fenced off Varosha, and threatened trespassers with death. And faced with this, the resort inevitably succumbed to the ravages of time. One Turkish Cypriot who grew up near Varosha said it's like living next door to a ghost. The houses had flower pots, curtains, but nobody was living there. Now wild asparagus and prickly pear bushes consume the once thriving resort. Sea turtles nest on beaches where celebrities once frolicked. Trees glow through living room floors and window box bougainvilleas overtake elegant houses. In other respects, though, Varosha remains flourishing in its celebrated heyday. Mannequins display outdated fashions in the windows of abandoned stores. 1974 model cars sit in a Toyota dealership and tables remain set for never-eaten breakfast. One former resident said the picture I had in my mind was a kind of paradise. But it felt like some sort of post-apocalyptic nightmare. Still, many of the exiles find it hard to escape the past, returning to the area to leave flowers and notes on the barbed wire fence that surrounds her former home. One message said, I left my soul inside. Open up. Well, in Alabama, there's a forgotten capital, Chahalba. Well, Buried at Cahaba is history that never made it into the historical record, according to the Cahaba Park director, Linda Derry. That includes the area's past as a mecca for freed African-American slaves. For Cahaba, after Cahaba became the capital of the newly established state of Alabama in 1820, the town boomed, becoming a frequent stop for two of the state's first steamboats and home to a state bank, a Capitol building, and two newspapers. But the area's low-lying land, which was built over an old Native American settlement at the confluence of the Cahaba and Alabama rivers, was prone to floods. After one destroyed the state house in 1825, legislators voted to relocate the state capital to Tuscaloosa, and Cahaba began to fade into the mist. In the 1840s and 50s, the town rebounded as a strategic port from which cotton was shipped downriver to Mobile, but the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861 led the Confederate Army to commandeer the newly built railroad and turn the cotton warehouse into Cahaba Federal Prison, where more than 3,000 Union POWs were eventually imprisoned. Though the war ended in 1865, the area, largely populated by former slaves, was devastated by another flood that same year. Over time, the bricks from the majestic mountains that could be found throughout Cahaba were used to build houses nearby Selma. By 1900, Cahaba was eventually deserted. Now known as Alabama's most famous ghost town, the area is the site of Old Cahaba Archaeological Park. Little remains of the former settlement, but you can still walk the deserted streets and see the ruins of old cemeteries, mansions, slave cabins, and the prison, and the Perrine Well, once the deepest artesian well in the world. A horsehead fountain is all that's left of the Cedar Garden maze that once belonged to C.C. Pegways, commander of the 5th Alabama Infantry. Pegways' ghost is said to appear to visitors in the form of a glowing orb, one of the many spirits that supposedly haunts the area. According to the park's director, you don't have to believe in ghosts to hear the past speak to you in Cahaba. Been there once. It's definitely worth the trip. Well, let's go to Austria, to Hitler's hidden homeland, Dahlesheim. Despite promises on the part of the German government, the villagers who were evacuated from Dahlesheim to serve Hitler's whims were never allowed to return. There was, after all, nothing left to return to. Some never received payment for their stolen land. Well, Adolf Hitler was a strange person. He once ranted, "People must not know who I am." He learned that somebody was investigating his mysterious past, which began with the unknown man who impregnated his great-grandmother, Maria Schickelgruber, in 1837. Her bastard son, Alois, became the Nazi leader's paternal grandfather. Now, this all is said to have taken place at Dahlesheim, a town in Austria, remote Wurttal region that was essentially erased from the map after Nazi Germany annexed Austria in 1938. The process of depopulating that area, it was 42 villages that were home to about 7,000 people, began almost immediately. According to one of the refugees, people had to leave fast and unexpectedly because they weren't given enough time to find new property and move there with all their possessions. And after the evacuation was complete, the village, including Maria's grave and the birthplace of the Fuhrer's father, was obliterated by German artillery to create a Wehrmacht training ground. Though it was never clear why this was done. An area so closely associated with Hitler's family couldn't have been used for battle training without his knowledge and permission, according to Austrian archivist Franz Jetzinger. So the question is why he gave it. One possible answer, bolstered by the memoirs of a Nazi lawyer by the name of Hans Frank, is that Maria had been impregnated by her employer, a Jewish man from Graz named Frankenberger, a legacy that Hitler may have spent a lifetime trying to erase. Did Hitler himself initiate the order for the destruction of Dahlesheim out of the insane hatred of his father and the desire to erase the shame of his Jewish blood? According to a question asked by historian Ron Rosenbaum, one thing is certain. No answers will be found in Dahlesheim, where a few scattered ruins are all that remain of its mysterious past. There are many mysteries for which we'll never have an answer. Well, let's go to the bottom of the world. Grit Viking. It's in South Georgia in the South Sandwich Islands. Born over piles of whale bones and little mountain streams, the body of Sir Ernest Shackleton was laid to rest forever in the little island cemetery of South Georgia. His head faces southward towards the Antarctic that he loved so well. Shackleton had quite a reputation as an explorer. In August of 1914, the Endurance, the flagship of explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton's Imperial Transit Antarctic expedition, set sail from London on an ambitious mission to explore Antarctica, the world's last uncharted continent. Shackleton meant to explore the region on foot, which was really the only way you could explore an area, according to him. Nearly 5 months into the voyage, Shackleton and the 27 crew members were only a day's sail from their destination when the ship became trapped in thousands of miles of pack ice in the Weddell Sea. 7 months after that, in October 1915, Shackleton and five men set out on a lifeboat to get help. Left their colleagues on Elephant Island just off the Antarctic Peninsula. Their only hope of assistance involved traveling more than 1,200 miles on drifting ice floes through the perilous Drake Passage to the tiny island of South Georgia, whose capital, Grit Viking, was the nearest outpost of civilization. The first official settlement on South Georgia, Grit Viking, had been founded as a whaling station in 1904. It was actually a joint venture between Norway and Argentina. It was known as the Argentine Fishing Company. The move was nothing if not risky. A great number of large whales had thin blubber and short baleens, and it wasn't worth the whalers' time catching them, according to the Royal Geographic Society in a statement they issued in 1895. But overhunting had depleted the whales in Europe's northern seas, where the demand for blubber, used for cosmetics, margarine, fertilizer, and lamp oil, remained as high as ever. Carl Anton Larsen, a Norwegian fishing captain who founded Grit Viking, confidently announced that South Georgia Island had one of the finest harbors imaginable, and the quantity of whales available gives no ground for fear. And, in hindsight, he was absolutely correct. Within a year, the Argentine Fishing Company produced 7,000 barrels of oil. Soon other whalers arrived, and seven stations were established on the island. Even after World War I broke out in 1914, the demand for whale oil continued. It was used to create the nitroglycerin used in explosives, for one thing, but overfishing once again decimated the population. By the mid-1930s, humpback whales were virtually extinct in the Antarctic. In 1965, whaling officially ended on South Georgia Island. Now, South Georgia Island and the nearby South Sandwich Islands are the southernmost remnants of the British Empire, and Grit Viking is a ghost town filled with abandoned whaling vessels. Its population primarily consists of penguins and seals who wander in and out of ruined buildings, while tourists are drawn to the area's spectacular bird watching. To this day, Grit Viking remains associated with Shackleton, who reached the town by hiking 22 miles with his men, finally rescuing all the members of the Imperial Transatlantic Expedition. After the explorer died of a heart attack in January of 1922, his wife had him buried in the cemetery of Grit Viking's Whaler's Church. Well, his grave still stands in the waste at the bottom of the world. Even in death, he became identified with Antarctica. Well, in Italy, we have Poggio Reale, the Vanished Village. You know, on January 15th, 1968. An earthquake measuring 6.1 on the Richter scale devastated the Italian island of Sicily, killed 231, injured thousands more, and destroyed the ancient village of Poggio Reale in the county Zambezi Valley. Rather than rebuild, the Italian government decided to construct an entirely new town in a supposedly safer location. According to one former Poggio Reale residents, a famous architect from all over Italy, came to visit us. They told us how we had to build a new village. I took part in the work as a worker myself, this former resident said. We built hundreds of cement boxes, and one day they gave us the keys and said, these are your new homes. This is your new town. Located about 2 miles, maybe 2.5, from the original location, a new, not-so-improved Pogorioli Nuova was built in less than 15 years, with no concern for tradition, history, or employment. The grocery stores, farmhouses, and courtyards where residents had worked and played over the centuries were replaced by sterile concrete blocks. But you used to live side by side. The town is full of gathering places, according to the town's current mayor, Lorenzo Pagliarelli. Neighborhoods in New Pogorioli are built far from each other. At the time, they didn't need a car to go downtown or visit a friend. Now they do. So in a sense, this is a story of two ghost towns. Though Pogorioli Nuova was built to house 10,000, only about 1,400 currently live inside the prefab structures. And the village's visitors mostly consist of stray dogs. Meanwhile, thousands of tourists flock to the roofless ruins of the original Pogorioli. According to Maurizio Carta, professor of city planning at the University of Palermo, it's waited patiently for history to reevaluate it. It waited for somebody to remember it sooner or later, and that's exactly what's happened. There are many abandoned towns all over the world. In Japan, we have the radioactive ruins of Okuma and Futaba. March 11, 2011, the 9.0 magnitude Tohoku earthquake struck off the northeast coast of Japan, triggering a tsunami that led to the meltdown of the three reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. That's about 150 miles north of Tokyo. The worst nuclear disaster since the 1986 Chernobyl accident. It showered the radioactive fallout throughout Fukushima Prefecture, particularly the bordering municipalities of Futaba and Okuma. According to one former resident, the plant was supposed to be safe. This was the promise we had. No industry in Futaba. To flourish, Futaba needed the plant. In the wake of the tragedy, an estimated 160,000 people were forced to evacuate, taking what few belongings they could carry on the buses and leaving behind half-washed clothes and laundromats, jackets, and clothing store windows and the tangled remains of ravaged buildings and the empty streets. Lesson plans remain written on the school blackboards, groceries set untouched on supermarket shelves, and cars were abandoned on the roads. Now, wild boars ravage the area. Futaba, Nami, and Tomioka are ghost towns whose emptiness is terrifying and show a tragedy that affected hundreds of thousands of people. According to Arkadiusa Podniansky, a photographer who documented the meltdown's aftermath, despite ongoing decontamination evidence, Futaba remains uninhabitable. But in April 2019, the Japanese government announced that two neighborhoods of Okuma, the town closest to the plant, are safe enough to live in. Still, radiation levels in the town remains 20 times higher than they were before the tragedy, and the contaminated earth is stored nearby. So it's hardly surprising that few former residents reportedly plan to return. Others are drawn back by the past. In June 2019, a 15-year-old boy and his mother briefly visited Futaba to put flowers on his father's grave. And at least one man did return to be near his departed loved ones. He said, I'm so old, I don't really care about the radiation levels. We want to visit our ancestors' graves, but we're living in a very lonely town. Now, the Then we have Henry Ford's Folly, Fordlandia in Brazil. In the late 1920s, Henry Ford was in the driver's seat, literally, having revolutionized the auto industry by using an assembly line system to mass produce cars. But in the late 1920s, the magnate encountered an unexpected obstacle when the British, having stolen rubber seeds from Brazil, started growing their own plants in Sri Lanka, securing a monopoly on the substance that Ford needed for his tires. Well, not to be outdone, he decided to grow his own plants. So in 1928, he spent $125,000 on 5,625 square miles on Brazil's Tapajos River. Dubbed Fordlandia, the venture was designed to be a utopian community with schools, hospitals, generators, a movie theater, and tennis courts. And not the least, Ford decided that the colony's lifestyle would involve a wholesome diet of oatmeal, canned peaches, and brown rice, along with temperance, which meant no drinking, gardening, and the salutary poetry of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. He said, "We're not going to South America to make money, but to help develop that wonderful and fertile land." Well, the dream was doomed from the start. Instead of following expert advice, Ford relied, foolishly as it turned out, on the instincts that had served him so well in business. Tell the New York Times in 1921, history is bunk. What difference does it make how many times the ancient Greeks flew their kites? Unfortunately, like so many legendary Greeks, Ford became the victim of his own hubris. Clearing the jungle proved to be back-breaking work. Inferior rubber tree seeds led to leaf blight, and the supposedly teetotaling residents began hitting the bottle. Spurred by a confrontation between a supervisor and a brick mason, a workers' revolt destroyed much of the town in 1930. In the end, the venture didn't produce enough rubber to manufacture a single tire. 1945, Ford, who was in failing health by this time, sold his property back to Brazil at a loss, and the American workers returned home. Fordlandia was abandoned to the jungle. Today, a rusting water tower, decaying clapboard bungalows, and piles of concrete crosses are all that's left of Ford's dream, though a few outliers have moved into the area. One resident told the New York Times in 2017, "Nothing ever happens here, and that's how I like it." And there's also, in the jungles of Brazil, a Confederate town. It was originally settled at the invitation of the Emperor of Brazil by former Confederate officers. Then in Turkey, we have Burjal Babas, the vacant villas. Seemed like a good idea at the time. In 2014, the Sarah Property Group spent the equivalent of $200 million to build Burj Al Babas, a luxury housing development in northwestern Turkey. Consider it the upscale Asian equivalent of the
motion detected at the front door
cookie-cutter communities that crowded the suburban United States. Hundreds of identical Gothic chateaus laid out in depressingly uniform lines. Costing up to $530,000 each, the Burj Al Babas village stands in sharp contrast to the area's traditional Byzantine and Ottoman architecture. The locals were not happy about this by any means. Believing wealthy investors would snap up the prefab palaces, Sarod had ambitious plans for the so-called Thermal Park, which was slated to include a movie theater, bathhouses, fitness clubs, and shopping centers. But the 2018 recession devastated Turkey's construction industry, and Burj Al Babas was abandoned with only 587 and 732 planned castles completed. Spurred by the failure, the Turkish government established regulations designed to preserve local character throughout the country, but some believe the damage had already been done. According to one Istanbul-based expert, I worry that projects like Burj Al Babas open Pandora's box. Developments without proper planning do not contextualize the geography and history of the surroundings. And many have exploded in Turkey since. Turns out that Burj Al Babas just really wasn't a good idea after all. A lot of money went down the tubes. Then we have Pomona in Namibia. 1908, a railway worker found a shiny stone on the ground by the tracks near Lüderitz on the west coast of German Southwest Africa, which is now known as Namibia. He turned a rock over to his supervisor, August Stauch. Turned out to be a diamond. News of the find triggered a local fortune hunting frizzy. Between June and December of 1908, roughly 40,000 carats were unearthed in the area, and Stauch believed that there were more to be found. On New Year's Eve, 1908, he and Professor Robert Scheib, a geologist from the Royal Mining Academy of Berlin, headed into central Namib Desert, where one of their workers found a trove of the priceless stones while working for firewood. Well, there were so many of the gems, the man's pockets overflowed and he began stuffing them into his mouth. He wasn't going to let any of them stay behind. Staunch became a millionaire overnight. Soon after Staunch's leader, it's discovered the German government established the area as part of the Sperrgebiet, or Forbidden Zone. 1912, after years of legal battles, Staunch and others established Pomona Forte, or Pomona Port, at the confluence of several diamond-studded valleys in the village Atlantic on the country's Atlantic coast. He named one of them Idatol, in honor of his wife, Ida. Though its reputation as a source of the area's largest diamonds, up to 52 carats, led to it being calling Marchental, or Fairy Tale Valley. By 1914, miners are unearthing more than 50,000 carats a month in Pomona, making it the richest diamond town in the world. And in its heyday, it had a population of roughly 1,500 and had a school, a church, a hotel, and a bowling alley. Fresh water arrived regularly via a narrow gauge railway from an outpost a few miles away, but only the Germans were allowed to use the upscale amenities in the village, while Namibian contract workers were forced to live in cramped dormitories. Well, by 1931, all good things have to come to an end, and the gems had grown scarce, and Pomona was finally abandoned. And today, it's primarily a ghost town. It's a long-forgotten railroad rusting in the sand. Although the Sperrgebiet, which is still a diamond mining site, has been designated a national park, it's largely off limits to visitors. It's interesting that so many millionaires are created by things that were just found laying in the dirt. Let's go to Saudi Arabia, the haunt of Jinn al-Ula.
Motion detected at the front door.
The walled city of al-Ula was founded on the Wadi al-Qura, a deserted valley in northwestern Saudi Arabia in the 6th century BC. Over time, it became an important link on the incense road, a series of routes that distributed spices and other goods throughout the ancient Middle East. It became a sacred stop for Islamic pilgrims from Damascus to Mecca. The Prophet Muhammad is said to have visited during on his way to the Battle of Tabuk in AD 630. In the 13th century, al-Ula residents moved to a higher spot in the red sandstone valley to avoid floods that overwhelmed the area during the rainy season. Thanks to its plentiful underground water sources, the city, currently called al-Ula Heritage Village or Old Town, remained occupied until the 20th century. At that time, residents, frustrated by overcrowding and failing infrastructure, began leaving. By 1983, al-Ula was entirely abandoned. Part of a larger settlement that includes Mada'in Salih, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the Ikma Mountain, a labyrinth of 800 rapidly disintegrating huts that once marked the great civilization, is closed to foreign visitors. But there is hope for the old city. A Saudi tourism initiative has pumped billions into the area, despite the fact many Muslims believe it's haunted by jinn, supernatural creatures of Arabian mythology. Muhammad himself allegedly warned people to avoid the site unless you're crying, unless you suffer the affliction. Well, the Prophet's injunction probably won't faze non-Muslim tourists, the focus of the Saudi campaign, who will come for a rare glimpse of a vanished past. Traditional Arab architecture, tombs carved into rock, ancient messages written on crimson cliffs. Key to the kingdom's heritage, according to the Amir Madani, a CEO of the Al-Rusta Royal Commission. It's the ancient Saudi Twitter, he said. Well, at this point, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night at the same time. And once again, if you listen to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show, until then, have a truly great evening.